You and I back together again, chatting it up and wrapping up another busy week on Friday, August 4th, 2023 on Connecticut Today. I had some thoughts from a prominent New York Times columnist on former President Trump's enduring popularity still with GOP voters. We welcome Dr. Barry Latzer, author of The Myth of Overpunishment, a defense of the American justice system and a proposal to reduce incarceration while protecting the public. And former Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso stopped by with his weekly update. Speaking of saying things, I found this fascinating, and this is getting a little bit of national play here. You're familiar with a guy named David Brooks? No fan of Donald Trump at all. He despises Donald Trump. He writes for the New York Times, right? So nothing. Gee, somebody at the Times doesn't like Donald Trump. Yeah, water's wet. A bear does you know what. The Pope's Catholic and the sky is blue and it's clear. Okay, we all know that. But David Brooks is a conservative, or what passes for a conservative at the New York Times. Brooks is at best a slightly right of center person, but he's about as close as you're going to get at the New York Times. You know, they probably break out in hives when he's in the building, but that's the way it is. And trust me, I've had friends that have interviewed the New York Times. And not real right-wingers either. I've had a couple of friends of mine, they said, hey, how'd it go with the Times last week? And they kind of both went, weird, man, just a weird vibe in that building. But I digress. David Brooks is apparently driving people nuts on Twitter because of something he said regarding, and I think this is instructive, why Donald Trump continues to have the appeal that he has. And this goes back to a couple of days earlier in the week where I told you a former co-worker of mine put up on one of her social media accounts, 45 and died it again, yet he still continues to lead the polls. And David Brooks, not that he saw her post, but that's kind of like the running question now. And although I do think the fall of his base is coming, the cracks are starting to show. Most people, though, sit back and say, what is it about the guy that still appeals to so many people that only now are people starting to think, well, maybe four or five indictments is a little much? David Brooks, who, like I said, is a slight conservative, but he's embraced at the New York Times, he shocked a lot of commentators when he admitted that he and the so-called elite, and he considers himself part of the elite, highly educated guy, and he works for the New York Times, he said they've used self-serving tactics to maintain power and a sense of moral superiority over the Trump supporters they detest. And this all weaves into what we've been reading over the past couple of weeks, all these pundits saying, when they go after Trump, when the perceived elites go after Trump, Republicans feel that they're going after them. You may not like it. You may say, oh, that's bullcrap, Paul. All right, I get it. But this is what is still providing him with significant support. David Brooks wrote in the New York Times the other day, I ask you to try on a vantage point in which we anti-Trumpers are not the eternal good guys. In fact, we're the bad guys. Now, I'm surprised the New York Times actually printed this, because I can imagine right now they must be going ballistic in the newsroom there. And all David Brooks said in that is, say, take the other side's point of view for a minute and try to lock into what they're thinking about how we, the elites, as Brooks admits he's one of, are the bad guys. Here's what Brooks wrote. I'll give you a couple of lines here, and it's very telling. Now, remember, this is a guy at the New York Times who is a conservative but is trying to figure out why Republicans are sticking in such numbers with Donald Trump. He said, over the last decades, we've taken over whole professions and locked everybody else out. Brooks pointed out in the media world that once had a lot of working class people in it, Ivy League and other elite level college graduates have come to dominate the newsrooms. He said, quote, when I began my journalism career in Chicago in the 1980s, there were still some old, crusty, working-class guys around the newsroom. Now, we're not only a college-dominated profession, we're an elite college-dominated profession. He said, quote, we built an entire social order that sorts and excludes people on the basis of the quality that we possess most, academic achievement. Highly educated parents go to elite schools, marry each other, work at high-paying jobs, and pour enormous resources into our kids who get into the same elite schools, marry each other, and pass their exclusive class privileges down from generation to generation. He adds, this same group has increasingly used buzzy language like problematic, cisgender, and Latinx that alienates the less educated class and further divides. See, what he is saying here, and I've tried to mention this, and a lot of you people understand it, you like it, you don't, but Donald Trump, for whatever reason, the way he speaks, his physical appearance, his use of the language, his use of satire, his use of nicknames, whether you despise this guy like Satan or love him like the Pope, he tapped into something. And I know people want to get rid of him. They don't want him to run. They want him to go to jail, whatever. But the smart people like Brooks and other people, they're looking at this and saying, you know what? He has been able to tap into something where he says, hey, they, the elites, and look, Trump's an elite. That's how smart the guy is. He went to an Ivy League school. He's worth a couple of $1 billion. He's a New York guy. But he was so good at what he did, and still to some point is, that he is able to tell people, look, they laugh at you. You people who wear jeans and T-shirts and still smoke cigarettes and drive pickup trucks and would rather drive a regular Ford F-150 than a Prius. And David Brooks is like, yeah, you know what? If we look at it from those folks' points of view, it's kind of right. And here it is. Here is, and I've said something like this for the past 7 years or so, 7 or 8 years that Trump has been on the scene here. And previous to that, when the media loved him, and every time Oprah had him on, she was, well, when are you going to run for president, Donald? David Brooks said, we can condemn the Trumpian populace all day until the cows come home, but the real question is, when will we stop behaving in ways that make Trumpism inevitable? Now, of course, he's getting destroyed on social media. Oh, you're making an excuse. No, he's not. He admits that he and a bunch of other people on both sides of the aisle are elitists, and to some point, they created what Donald Trump is doing, and it was just a matter of time. Crime punishment, the judicial system, not only here in the U.S., but in Connecticut, we talk about it a lot on programs like this. People are mad, angry. Some are happy. How are we doing here? Could we do any better? Our next guest wrote and published 6 books, including a treatise on state constitutional law, over 70 scholarly articles as well. For over 3.5 decades, he was a professor of criminal justice at John Jay College, CUNY, where he was a member of the master's and doctoral faculties, as well. Dr. Barry Latzer joins us. Name of the book, The Myth of Overpunishment, A Defense of the American Justice System and a Proposal to Reduce Incarceration. while protecting the public. What an idea. Dr. Latzer, hi, it's Paul at WICC. How are you?
I'm doing great, Paul, and it's great to be with you.
Well, thank you so much. How are we doing, doctor, with this whole thing? You talk about the myth of overpunishment. Who is holding that myth, if it's there, and where did it come from?
Well, the progressives, the so-called woke crowd, are propounding this concept that we're overpunishing everybody. But when you look at the numbers, Paul, it doesn't add up. For instance, you can't just look at the sentences that people get. Mm-hmm. You also have to look at the time they actually serve. In fact, only 20% of people who are sentenced end up serving the full time that the judge imposed on them. So you can't look at just sentences. And that's just one illustration, Paul, of the misunderstanding or really misrepresentation of the problem.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a great delineation there, a misunderstanding or a misrepresentation. I mean, I hear this constant drone, Dr. Latzer, about, oh, this is, we have a draconian system. And the one that drives me crazy is, well, we need to have fewer people in jail. Well, do we? Do we not need to balance that out with protecting the public interest, right?
Absolutely. The people, and I would differentiate jail from prison because, you know, jail's where you go when you're arrested, although nowadays often you don't.
Yeah.
The streets are where you go after you're arrested, back on them, so to speak. But okay, let's talk about prison, where the serious offenders go.
Sure.
I mean, the notion that the people in prisons in the United States are just a bunch of kids smoking pot on the street corner. It's just ludicrous and frightening because the people in there are very serious offenders. 56% of them have done murders, rapes, robberies, assault, sex assault, and other crimes of violence. That's an overwhelming majority of them. And I can go through the list with you, Paul, but the point is these are serious offenders. Very serious offenders. And here's what's worse. When the Justice Department, the Bureau of Justice Statistics, studied the released offenders, the guys who were set free, right, from prison,
sure,
they found that they, by 83%, were rearrested within years of their release. 83% of them rearrested. So not only have these guys done serious crimes, but then they repeat them when they get out. So, I mean, I don't know what these decarcerationists are talking about, really. They don't know what they're talking about. And this kind of stuff is just distributed widely in the United States through the media that trends left, their magazines, their television shows, and it's just a whopper, as we used to say.
Yeah, yeah. Dr. Barry Latzer is the guest, the myth, of overpunishment, a defense of the American justice system, and a proposal to reduce incarceration while protecting the public. So, Dr. Latzer, how do we do that? How do we reduce incarceration and still keep the public happy and protected?
Well, the one thing we're not going to do, Paul, if we're smart, is arbitrarily release people from prison. I've seen proposals, wacky proposals. We should reduce prison size by 50%. We should reduce prison size by 30%.
I mean, what does that
really
mean? Are they just pulling numbers out of the sky?
I think so, because how can you even talk about reducing prison size without discussing the crime rates, without discussing the numbers of arrests? I mean, they must be smoking something, right? It's hard to understand how they can make this argument. Now, there are things I think we can do. We can rely on technology more to deal with the people who are released. I'm not talking about the real bad guys that I spoke of earlier who are doing all these awful crimes. But we release a lot of people, even people who are convicted of felonies. In fact, people convicted of felonies are released at much higher rates than you might realize. 31% of all convicted felons, and 23% of violent offenders are released without spending a single day in prison. Now, if you're going to release people, Paul, here's my argument.
Okay.
Wire them up. Give them the ankle bracelet. Monitor where they're going. If, for instance, there's a crime with a victim, a guy beats his girlfriend up, right? Or even beats her children, their children up, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now let's give him an ankle bracelet, and we can adjust it using technology so that if he enters a no-go zone, a geo-fenced area, the techies call it, right? If he enters a zone where that woman lives or where that woman works or where their children go to school, the red flash goes off, the authorities are alerted, and they can respond. Now, to me, that's a great idea. Now we release a guy like that from prison or jail, and theoretically he's monitored by a probation officer if he's on probation or a parole officer if he's been released from prison.
Yeah.
But you and I both know, everybody knows, these officers are up to their eyeballs with cases, right? They can't walk around day to day watching the behavior of these guys.
No.
But the electronic monitoring can watch them, can at least deter them somewhat, because they have a sense that they're being monitored. They know they're being monitored.
The thing,
so this is my proposal.
No, that's not a bad idea, Dr. Latzer, but also the thing that drives me crazy, and obviously you're in New York City, you've been in the area for years, you know about this, these district attorneys now, this fusillade of DAs, and thankfully, I always say here in Connecticut, one of the few things, Doctor, we do right here in Connecticut, we don't elect anybody to do with law enforcement, so thank God we're one of the few states left that does not politically elect DAs. But man, these left-leaning DAs just putting people back on the street, my God, how do we stop that?
Yeah. I've just reviewed, in fact, a new book on the subject. They call them rogue prosecutors.
Yeah.
Good name for it, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, the public, you know, the DAs may be woke, Paul, but the public is falling asleep in some of these counties.
Well, they're voting for them.
Really,
they're voting for them.
They are. Now, part of the reason for this is that they're Democrats and they're running in big cities where the Democrat always wins. So the real battle is in the primaries beforehand, and the public doesn't get involved in these primaries.
Mm-hmm.
Factor two, you get money, big money, okay, from left-leaning advocates, and they throw a lot of money in these DA races, and so that enhances the vote power of these progressive prosecutors. And they get elected, they get into office. Now, bunches of them are being thrown out. I noticed in this book that I was reviewing, they discuss 8 different woke prosecutors, and 4 of them have already been either booted out of office or they left for other reasons. So they may not last long. I hope that's the case, because their effort to reduce incarceration by not prosecuting essentially misdemeanors, right?
Yeah.
Is really misguided.
I mean, look.
That is really misguided.
When you have a guy like Chesa Boudin, I think, who was booted. Well, listen, when you're, doctor, when you're too liberal for San Francisco, that tells you something, right?
Can you imagine? Right.
Could you imagine that?
You know, you're living in a place like Hartford, right? I mean, do you really want people who commit misdemeanors in Hartford just turned loose willy-nilly? No. And after a while, the cops won't arrest them, will they?
Well,
the DA says, I'm not prosecuting. Are you going to arrest them? No, they won't arrest them.
You know what, Dr. Latzer? I've had a couple of callers here in Connecticut with the law enforcement backgrounds, and one was still active law enforcement. And he said, Paul, this is the God's honest truth. I have a buddy of mine on a local police force, and he took in this juvenile so many times. The juvenile, are you sitting down for this? The juvenile helped the cop fill out the arrest report.
He knew better than the cop
he
had to
knew
fill it out
he
by
had
now,
been
right?
arrested. Okay, you put that over there. My name goes over here. I mean, what does that tell you?
Oh, my God.
Let me ask you, Dr.
Tells you we have a recidivism problem on top of everything else.
All right, so let me let you, with your years of teaching criminal justice and all this in the Big Apple, so let me ask you, finally, to wrap up here, to peer into your crystal ball. 5 years from now, for having this conversation, where do we stand 5 years from now?
Well, the truth is, despite all of what we said, I don't see a big crime wave in this country. I really don't. However, there are always unforeseen. I mean, look at the pandemic. Who predicted that?
Yeah.
Look at the George Floyd protests, which really went out of control in so many places. Who predicted that?
Yeah.
So, you know, you got to be careful with your crystal ball. But I don't see the factors long term for a big crime rise, which I lived through. I'm an old guy, and I remember the awful 70s and 80s and early 90s. So I remember that awful period.
Yeah, that's
but
when
I
they,
don't see that happen.
That's really. When they called New York City. I love when they say this. Yeah, the city was gritty back then. Gritty? Where are you coming
gritty.
Up with?
Gritty means you better watch your wallet.
Well, exactly. Great stuff. Thank you. The name of the book is The Myth of Overpunishment, A Defense of the American Justice System, and a Proposal to Reduce Incarceration While Protecting the Public. Dr. Barry Latzer, the guest, and a foreword by Senator Tom Cotton. Doctor, thank you. We appreciate it, and we'll chat down the road. Thanks.
It was great, Paul. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. All right, folks, there it is. Pick it up at your local bookstore, your local book retailer, Barnes & Noble, or at Amazon, The Myth of Overpunishment, A Defense of the American Justice System, and a Proposal to Reduce Incarceration While Protecting the Public. Former Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso, never at a loss for what's on his mind. He stops by now with his Friday thoughts. Chris, you haven't been indicted on anything in the past week, have you? No?
No, other than that I watched the Goodfellas the other night. That's probably about it.
That's it. So you're not in a motorcade of Cadillac Escalades going to the federal courthouse?
No, I want to sleep well at night. You know, okay. I don't think I could do well. My mother, Teresa, if I ever did something like that, oh my God, even though she's gone now, I'd hear it, you know?
Right. What's on your mind, Chris, on this Friday?
Well, you know, it's probably what's on the mind of a lot of people, the indictment of Donald Trump. And I think it was justified, you know, but in all fairness, he's innocent until proven guilty. But I think anyone in positions that he was in and, you know, accused of involved in the January 6th insurrection, you know, should be prosecuted. And same thing with Hunter Biden, I should say. If there's something wrong that he did and, you know, facts can be assessed and, you know, an indictment made, the same thing there. I think it's important for the system that, you know, everyone who allegedly violates the law is brought to justice. I think that's the only way the system works the right way. And I know some people are not going to agree over the Trump indictment, but you know, there are a lot of people in that situation that at the Capitol that beat up on cops or did something illegal, entered the building unlawfully, caused damage, and they're serving pretty hefty terms, Paul, as you could, you know, they've been convicted. And so, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And again, he's innocent until proven guilty, but I think it's incumbent upon the judicial system to follow through and to prosecute those who we're in violation of the law.
And Chris, again, I've been cautioning people here. Wait till the proceedings come out. Now they may take a while, but there are going to be witnesses against him, and these witnesses have sworn, Chris, under the penalty of perjury and going to jail, that what they're saying is true. And all I urge people, and I'm sure, Chris, you know people like this too. You're probably telling them, let's just wait, take a breath, and see what the testimony is. That's all.
Oh, absolutely. And I really believe that the proceedings, the court proceedings, should be televised. I think this is an unusual situation where it's the first former president to be indicted. And I think it should be open for the public to see. Mm-hmm. So everyone gets to see it, good, bad, and the ugly. Everyone gets to see it, gets to see the line of questioning, the evidence that's presented. I think that bodes well for the judicial system. And I know there's people out there, oh, you know, the judicial system doesn't work and it's this and it's that, but it's probably the best system in the world,
sure,
when you think about it, in mm-hmm. a free society. So let it be heard. I hope Chief Justice Roberts, you know, instructs the judge to open the proceeding so it can be televised. I think it would be the best thing for the public to see.
Anything else on your mind, Chris?
Well, you know, you were pretty aggravated today over some traffic issues, huh?
Oh, Chris, don't get me. Whenever and that's just me. I know people don't agree with me, but when I'm hearing excuses for passing school buses,
And Paul, you know, it's gotten to a point now. I think people are making up their own vehicle laws now. The newest thing is just rolling through stop signs. Not even hesitate, just roll right through onto the main thoroughfare, you know, and not a blink. You know, if you hit them, oh, my God, you're wrong. But it's just happening more and more. Pedestrians just walking right out in the middle of the street, you know, traffic's driving, not waiting, just walking right out. I don't know what it is, Paul. I don't know if it's a generational thing, if it's just a lawlessness, but you're absolutely right. These actions only hurt people in the long run. You know, passing a bus, for example, a school bus. You know how kids are. They dart out in front of the street. I had a constituent, a young boy, he was 3 years old.
Yeah.
And his parents were, you know, one of the houses in my district. And the ice cream truck came by. Well, the young boy, his name was Errol, ran across the street and got hit by the truck. And sadly died. He was 3 years old. And his father called me up, very distraught, but he said, you know, I want to do something so this doesn't happen to other kids. And so as a result of it, I was on the city council back then. But now all the ice cream trucks are equipped with the, you know, the stop signs, the arms that come out, similar to a school bus.
Yeah.
And, you know, things like that that make the world better. But when you have drivers just ignore it, that child is open again to be hurt, or someone, you know, especially school buses. So I would hope people just follow the rules.
Yeah.
They are there for a reason, you know?
Yeah, and Chris, I just hope in the year or two when the process is finally opened and cities like Bridgeport and Hartford and New Haven and small towns, big and small, are going to start debating putting up stop sign cameras or speed cameras or whatever, now that the framework is in place, dear God, I don't want to hear about a racial motive for this. Because, Chris, last time I looked, gas pedals and brake pedals work the same way for whoever is pressing them. You know what I mean?
Of course they do, Paul. And, you know, we've gotten into society, we assign everything by race, which is the wrong thing to do. You know, the other thing I'm seeing a lot of is public intoxication now.
Oh.
I've never seen before, down in the parks, on city streets and, you know, private parking lots, people drinking and doing it openly, you know, actually the bottles of liquor on the car trunk, or, you know, they put them in plastic cups and things like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's unlawful. And all that is someone gets in the car who's drinking, and now the chance of them, you know, committing an accident is going to increase.
Mm-hmm.
But it's this lawlessness. And listen, I've seen black people, I've seen Hispanic, I've seen white people do it. It's wrong no matter what race you are or who you are. You know, there's a law there for a reason. It's to protect everyone. And when someone violates it, it creates issues. There's no question about it. But, you know, we've gotten into that, Paul, unfortunately. Now everything is looked at race. And it's sad because many things can't be looked in the lens of race. It just can't.
No.
You know, the violation of law is violation of law no matter who does it, you know.
Absolutely. And, Chris, finally, let me ask you, as I was talking about the past couple of days, I guess we're about halfway through the two-week period now of the candidates who want to get on the ballot for an anticipated mayoral primary coming up. 2,000 signatures, I think, is what they all have to get. Thoughts on that? What are you hearing? Anything out there? It's not an easy thing to do. I know that. What are you hearing?
No, you know, and I think it's meant not to be easy because, you know, you can get candidates, especially fringe candidates, that are not serious about running but like to just, you know, clog up the process. And the reason for the petitions is it's reachable. You can reach the number but it means you have to put work in and you have to have supporters that will go out and help you. Mm-hmm. You know, the most accurate way to do it is a door-to-door process. So you have to knock on doors, but it also gives you an opportunity to meet voters. From what I'm hearing, you know, it looks like John Gomes is doing okay.
Yeah.
Recently on Facebook, though, he's asking people to come to his headquarters and sign the petitions. You know, I'm hearing that, you know, Maryland's out there and so is Lamon Daniels. I think both of them are having a little bit more of a struggle because they don't have the infrastructure or the amount of people to do the process. And I think Maryland also encouraged people to go into her headquarters. So I think it's going to get down to the wire. But, you know, this weekend in particular is going to be the big time because you've got, you know, 2 days, this Sunday and Saturday, to go out and really make an effort, you know. So it's going to be wait and see. The other thing is you need 2,000, but you never just get 2,000.
Oh, of course not.
Right. So you probably need a cushion of about a total of 3,000 to have a comfortable cushion there.
Well,
yeah.
Okay.
So it's a Herculean task, but with the right organization. When I ran for mayor, Paul, in 2003, the day that we took out the petitions, the next morning we turned them all in. And what I took pride in was we had an army of people, and we didn't pay anyone to go out and do it. It was all volunteers. 2007, when I ran for mayor again, it took us 2 days, and we turned them all in.
Wow.
And again, all volunteers. I didn't have to pay a penny for anyone to go, you know, and be part of the process. And you know, in order to run for mayor, I think you need an army of people to get the job done because it also tells the voters that you're serious about it and that you have a following of people that really want to, you know, work to get you elected.
Interesting. Chris, thank you. Have a great weekend.
Okay.
We'll chat next week. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Take care, Paul.
There you go. All right. So interesting that Chris Caruso and our buddy Lenny Grimaldi saying about the same thing, that it looks like John Gomes will get the minimum 2,000 verified signatures to get on a primary ballot with Mayor Ganim coming up on September 12th, and it might be a little bit of a tougher go for Lamon Daniels and Marilyn Moore. We shall see.